Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 29, and the end is in sight for over a quarter of a million Germans and their allies surrounded in the Stalingrad Kessel, the Cauldron. Last week, we heard how Manstein and Hoth had decided to call it a day and turn around despite being so close to the south of the city on Christmas Eve. The Russians were throwing everything at the 6th Panzer Division, and General Hoth had no ammunition, fuel, no reinforcements. On the 28th of December 1942, Joseph Stalin was fuming back in Moscow. There were at least 7 Russian armies tied down trying to defeat General Paulus, and they had still not taken the city back from the Germans. He was also growing very tired of hearing the mostly exaggerated reports from his field commanders, including impossible boasts such as 3,250 tanks captured and 1,800 aircraft destroyed. The Germans didn't even have 1,800 aircraft in the area, let alone 3,000 tanks. Stalin seemed to be aware of these discrepancies. The Russian commanders failed to understand that the boasts would lead to Stalin eventually asking a fundamentally logical question. If so many were being taken prisoner and all the equipment was being destroyed, why hadn't they surrendered? On the same day that Stalin was pacing about his office, General Vatutin at Soviet Southeast Front headquarters on the Upper Don phoned him with news of another overwhelming victory. "The Italian 8th Army's entire right wing had melted away," warbled Vatutin. 60,000 prisoners and about the same number killed, stores seized by our forces, the pitiful remains are not putting up any resistance. Stalin listened to Vatutin, who was clearly excited and puffed up. The Russian dictator was more worried about the possibility of a German counterattack, and there were already signs. The main problem was Tatsinskaya airfield, taken by the Russians only 4 days before and watched by the Luftwaffe 2IC General Martin Fiebig. Last episode, we heard how he'd only just managed to make it out flying to Rostov, which lay to the southwest of Stalingrad. But a Russian armoured column had ended up being trapped at Tatsinskaya airfield by lead elements of the German panzers rushed from their aborted relief drive towards Stalingrad. The Russians had escaped but suffered a number of casualties. Now Stalin reminded his generals about the danger that the Russian 24 tanks could be surrounded along with their commander, General Badenov. Stalin lectured Vatutin about tank warfare. "You should bear in mind that over long distances tank corps are best launched in pairs," the dictator intoned. "Otherwise they risk falling into a situation like Badenov. Get him out at any cost," he thundered. And yet Stalin was transfixed by another problem. Paulus's 6th Army, which continued to fight despite suffering from starvation and very little ammunition. As I said, 7 Russian armies were involved in Stalingrad, which were urgently required in other theatres, particularly in Leningrad and to bolster the forces around Moscow. The major issue Stalin was facing was in the command structure. Remember, there were 2 generals in charge of the south, Rokossovsky and Yeremenko. Field Marshal Zhukov, for once, said nothing when Stalin asked, "Who gets the assignment?" There was silence at first, then one of those peasants suggested Lieutenant General Rokossovsky. "Why don't you say anything?" Stalin prodded Zhukov. Zhukov replied, "The general was capable, sitting very firmly on the fence." But he did follow up with, "Yeremenko's feelings will be hurt, of course." That was shrugged off by Stalin, who said, "We are not high school girls, we are Bolsheviks and must put worthwhile leaders in command. Telephone Yeremenko and tell him about the decision." Actually, girls from high school had been fighting the Germans across most theatres in the Soviet Union, so the analogy was ironic. Yeremenko reacted terribly when phoned by Zhukov. "Transfer the 57th, 64th and 62nd armies from the Stalingrad front to Rokossovsky's control," Zhukov blurted bluntly down the telephone line. Yeremenko had to spend 15 minutes calming down before he phoned Zhukov back, then passed on a message for Stalin. "I want to stay here until the enemy is completely destroyed," he said. But Stalin wouldn't budge, and Yeremenko lost his main armies. He was now to take orders from Rokossovsky. Yeremenko would have to chase the Germans towards Rostov. If you cast your mind back to our earlier podcast, you'll remember that Yeremenko was rushed to Moscow 8 days after the Germans invaded Russia in June 1941, taking over control of the Soviet Western Front. That was after the original commander, Dmitry Petrov, was dismissed and then executed for incompetence. So Yeremenko was regarded as one of the most effective generals, and here he was, demoted. Yeremenko had also fired 62nd Army Commander General Lopatin, who had suggested there was no way to stop the Germans at Stalingrad before the battle began. He had installed Choikov, which was really a masterstroke. Now here he was, cast away like Lopatin. Yeremenko retreated to his private quarters, and the hero of the First and Second World War burst into tears. Nikita Khrushchev tried to console him, but he snapped, "Comrade, you don't understand. You're a civilian." Back outside the Kessel, there were momentous battles for control over the all-important airfields. As we've seen, the Germans counterattacked against Russian General Budanov's 24th Tank Corps at Tatsinskaya, which had concerned the Stavka. Stalin's fears were unfounded. But the Luftwaffe was managing by some miracle to fly between 80 and 200 tons into Stalingrad daily at this point. That was far less than the 550 tons required per day, but extended Paulus's fight, angering Stalin further. Hundreds of anti-aircraft batteries were now emplaced along Potomac Airfield, and they took a terrible toll on the lumbering Junker 52s in particular. 300 were shot down in 5 weeks, far off the Looney Tunes number dreamed up by the Russian commanders briefing Stalin, but the big problem was there were no spare planes, let alone spare parts. Just to add injury to insult, the weather got worse. As New Year's Day approached, the roads around the Kessel, and particularly to the vital Potomac airfield, became impassable. Sappers tried to clear the roads, working in gas masks, the temperature was so low, blizzards blowing snow back over their tracks in hours. It was the last day of 1942, and soldiers were now sticking the bones, or legs, of hundreds of dead horses into the snow as trail markers for truck drivers. Then one of the most remarkable pieces of fumbled intelligence proved two things. Firstly, no one in the Nazi party really trusted each other, and secondly, that Hitler and his second-in-command Hermann Göring dismissed some catastrophic intelligence reports as far too shocking to be true. What happened was Hitler's liaison officer, Major Kulistin von Zitzewitz, who had arrived in 6th Army headquarters inside the Kessel, was providing the OKW back in Rastenburg with very accurate reports. In fact, he was so utterly and totally accurate about what he reported, it led to disbelief. Paulus's chief of staff was also a committed Nazi, General Arthur Schmidt, and he wanted Hitler and Zeitzler to receive more optimistic data. So Schmidt kept interfering with Zitzewitz's dispatches to East Prussia, doctoring the messages Zitzewitz carefully compiled. But the data backstabbing deception didn't end there. Zitzewitz knew that Schmidt had developed the habit of going to bed early, so after a while he merely waited for the general to nod off before he sent his accurate reports to the OKW. He was an extremely thorough young Nazi and went everywhere, frontline foxholes, hospitals, ammunition dumps, ravines. He stumbled along with German troops conducting night missions in the mile-long bulkers at Barbukin, Gorodishki, and Dmitrievka. He saw their clammy blankets in the shallow trenches, the pneumonia, the colds, the flu, the weakness, the sickness. He counted the legions of lice. Zitzewitz witnessed a case where rats had chewed off a number of toes of a soldier suffering from bad frostbite. He dutifully noted it down. Surely the Führer needed to know. What shocked Hitler's liaison officer most was what he saw at Potomac Airfield. Wounded were lying in the open or in hastily laid out tents, waiting for doctors, while Junkers and Heinkels circled and landed or were hit and crashed. It was a vision of chaos and disorder, and his superiors needed to know. Major Zitzewitz spared nothing as he dutifully filed these reports back to OKW, but Hermann Göring shook his head in disbelief after reading them. "It is impossible that any German officer could be responsible for defeatist messages of this sort," he declared. "The only possible explanation is that the enemy has captured his transmitter and has sent them himself." Hitler agreed. Zitzewitz's reports were dismissed as Russian propaganda. False news. It was New Year's Eve and the party was about to begin. At precisely 10 p.m. local time, Russian artillery around the Kessel opened up in what appeared to be frenzied acknowledgement of the new year. The Red Army was operating on Moscow time, 2 hours ahead of German clocks. In their rats' nests, the 6th Army were expecting this. 15 minutes later, it was over, a salvo welcoming a year in which the 6th Army would be destroyed. Inside Stalingrad, the revitalized Russian 62nd Army had a party on New Year's Eve. A number of well-known actors, musicians, and even ballerinas had been flown in to entertain the troops. Historian William Craig tells a great story about one of the troop members who was a violinist called Mikhail Goldstein. The talented violinist decided he'd rather play for the soldiers instead of the officers, so he headed off to the west bank of the Volga. There he was, ensconced in the middle of Stalingrad's shattered city center, playing as he'd never played before. He performed pieces by a number of German composers, particularly Bach, which was actually banned by the Soviet government at the time. Goldstein took the chance that the political commissars would turn a deaf ear to this infringement, where Teutonic tones were invading the earlobes of all about. The melodies were amplified through loudspeakers and drifted to the nearby German trenches. The shooting suddenly ceased. In this eerie quiet, the beautiful sound of his violin flowed through the apocalyptic landscape surreally. Then he finished. A hushed silence hung over the Russian soldiers. Suddenly, from German territory, a voice could be heard, and in halting Russian, a lancer shouted, "Play some more Bach, we won't shoot." So Goldstein placed his violin under his chin and played a lively Bach gavotte. The war slipped from the minds of those who listened, the guns silenced for a short while. They would be back killing each other within the hour, but now art echoed through a part of the crushed downtown. At midnight Berlin time, the Germans then fired their tracers into the air around the entire Kessel. Anyone watching would have been struck by the ring of fire symbolizing the trapped Germans, a ring of futility like raging at the moon. But Paulus remained almost insanely optimistic in public. He wrote a stirring New Year message to his troops. "Our will for victory is unbroken, and the New Year will certainly bring our release. When this shall be, I cannot say. The Führer has, however, never gone back on his word, and this time will be no different." Well, that was pretty much an outright lie. The Führer constantly went back on his word. Take the signing of a peace pact with Russia that he broke with Operation Barbarossa as the most visible example, let alone the so-called peace deal brokered by poor Neville Chamberlain. In fact, Hitler's entire persona was a lie. His real name wasn't even Hitler. It was Schickelgruber, but try yelling "Hail Schickelgruber" to inspire a beer hall full of drunkards. That's because Schickelgruber means digger of sewers or sump digger. But the flow of hubris continued. Hitler had his own New Year's message for the trapped 6th Army. "In the name of the whole German people, I send you and your valiant army the heartiest good wishes for the new year," he said in italics to be delivered across the Kessel. "The hardness of your perilous position is known to me. I and the whole German Wehrmacht will do everything in our power to relieve the defenders of Stalingrad, and that with your staunchness will come the most glorious feat in the history of German arms, Adolf Hitler." It's just incredible how psychopathic narcissists have a real character trait, a propensity to use phrases like greatest, most glorious, best, biggest, most intelligent, greatest leader in history, most successful ever. Then their people suffer the consequences of their deception and lies. In Novocherkassk, Field Marshal Erich von Manstein greeted the new year without a smile as he thought about those inside the Kessel. He'd failed to save Paulus, and the 6th Army's fate was sealed, whatever Mr. Schickelgruber said. And yet Manstein had another crisis, which was taking place 400 miles south of Stalingrad. That's where Army Group A's 1st Panzer Division and 17th Armies were now at risk, alone and vulnerable in the foothills of the Caucasus Mountains. They must head north immediately through the terribly dangerous bottleneck city of Rostov, or Zhukov's master plan may just work. It was only on the 29th of December that Hitler eventually relented and agreed to allow the retreat of the 1st Panzer Army. But the Russians were already rushing towards Rostov. They were determined to destroy the entire German southern armies, and their commander, Yeremenko, had something to prove. By New Year's Day, German posts observed a massive build-up on the south and western edges of the Kessel. Hundreds of T-34 tanks churned through the snow, as well as troop trucks, and the Russians were hiding nothing. It was brazen. The Germans could do very little. They were down to their last few rounds and would only open fire if directly attacked, and the Russians knew it. Stalin had also agreed to dispatch the man the Russians regarded as an artillery genius, Nikolai Nikolaevich Voronov, to the edge of the Kessel. He proposed the installation of thousands of guns along a line 7 miles long. That would be more than enough to punch a hole through the Kessel wall and would be a mix of Katyusha rockets all the way up to 210mm siege howitzers. General Choikov would then lead the rejuvenated 62nd Army as they cleared the city from the western shores of the Volga. Choikov's men were given the significant tactical role of destroying the units in the pocket, and he relished the moment. It was payback time. But first, Rokossovsky wanted to make sure that Choikov was actually ready for this crucial assignment. He asked whether the 62nd Army would be able to defeat the enemy forces coming towards it, preventing them from reaching the Volga if the Germans tried to break out of the coming assaults from the west, north, and south. General Krylov, who was Choikov's aide, said simply, "If in the summer and autumn all Paulus's forces were unable to drive us into the Volga, then the hungry and frozen Germans won't even move 6 steps eastwards." The first week of 1943 saw the Russian 62nd Army shock troops intimidating the frozen and hungry Germans inside Stalingrad, who gave ground slowly as the fighting moved from basement to basement, workshops, apartments, workers' homes, through the streets, across shattered parks. The firefights were endless. Civilians who had been trapped when the Germans overran the city began emerging, emaciated, sick. While all of this was going on, 25 miles west of the city, Potomac Airfield had by now begun to resemble something from the darkest of the Dark Ages. Frozen bodies were stacked in piles as the German wounded continued dying of exposure, their wounds, and then secondary infections. At the same time, administration staff were being flown out to set up new divisions outside the pocket. As the doctors wrote out death certificates, they avoided mentioning starvation. A few rebelled, but were quickly silenced and lapsed into furious quiet. More lies and deception. The Nazi way. "Killed in action," wrote the officers, when they knew that all it would have taken was a plate of pasta with a simple sauce and their men may have survived. Those languishing in the burned-out city had lost virtually all sense of humanity. Russian author Vasily Grossman summed up their experience. "The Germans in the city," he said, "sit like savages in Stone Age caves, devouring horse flesh in smoke and gloom amidst the ruins of a beautiful city that they have destroyed." Meanwhile, Paulus had decided to take a quick tour of the Kessel to assess his men's morale. Early on the morning of the 3rd of January, he travelled to the Austrian 44th Infantry Division after captured men from there had been heard on Russian propaganda broadcasts reporting shortages of food and ammunition, as well as heavy casualties. While he discussed matters with a divisional commander, General Dubois, he was interrupted by a heavy attack by Russian tanks. That applied his mind. Battalions and companies were so weak that they had become meaningless designations. Out of all the soldiers left in the Kessel, less than 1 in 5 were frontline troops. Companies had 12 men left that were fit for duty. Fragments of units were amalgamated into battle groups. Panzer grenadiers were mixed with Cossack platoons and Luftwaffe companies. Sergeant Major Walwe of the Grenadiers was sent with this mishmash of troops to defend the most exposed position, the nose of the Anteater, or the southwestern extremity of the Kessel. If you looked at the map and guessed where the Russians were going to attack, it would be there, and Walwe knew it. On the 5th of January, the mild thaw of the last 48 hours changed again as the mercury dropped to minus 35 degrees centigrade. The Germans who'd commandeered Russian Valenki felt boots were happy. They worked better in the snow. And now the 6th Army was not only surrounded, they were becoming more and more isolated from any other German units. Papa Hoth's original relief expedition was now more than 80 miles away from the Kessel after New Year's Day, forced to retreat continuously by Russian divisions in hot pursuit. Hoth was one of the most skilled German commanders, and he employed extremely creative techniques to slow the Russians, called an elastic withdrawal. He would wriggle and turn, then turn back on his tail, feinting and bobbing like a wounded boxer, then turn again like an elastic band. The longer he held off the Russians from Rostov, the more time Army Group South in the Caucasus had to get out. But when Hitler found out about the elastic withdrawal, he ordered Hoth to stop dead in his tracks and fight where he was. Field Marshal Manstein finally had had enough. On January 5th, he abruptly sent Hitler a resignation message. "Should this headquarters continue to be tied down, I cannot see any useful purpose will be served by my continuing as commander of the Don Group Army." And for once, Hitler backed down and backed off, Hoth continued his elastic withdrawal. Doggedly following Hoth was Andrei Yeremenko. He had been so stung by his recent demotion in favor of Rokossovsky, he wanted to show Stalin his true mettle. Yeremenko was gunning for Rostov in an attempt to foil the German Army Group A's retreat from the Caucasus. He believed his entire career depended on it. And Yeremenko was making pretty good time. He had already taken back Kotelnikovo, 50 miles east of Rostov, within the first week of January. The stories of what the civilians had endured at the hands of the Germans infuriated Red Army soldiers, who decided that they'd make short work of any captured Wehrmacht. Rape, murder of children, 300 boys and girls shipped to Germany as slave labor. The Red Army officers became more and more grim-faced as they heard these stories from town after town as they pushed on heading southwesterly. That's when Sergeant Alexei Petrov was forced by his HQ to commit a war crime on his own citizens. As the artillery and the leading Russian divisions arrived at a steppe village, the residents inexplicably attacked them with pitchforks and hammers. After the adulation they'd experienced from other Russians, they were shocked. Then the penny dropped. These weren't Russians. They were Kazakhs, who screamed insults and shouted that they didn't want any Russians. They had suffered during Stalin's purges and were sick and tired of the communists. Pavlov contacted division headquarters for advice what to do. The response was terse. Destroy them all! Petrov ordered high explosive shells to be fired into the mud, clay and timber village. Then machine guns picked off anyone who ran. The Cossacks were killed down to the last child. For the rest of his life, Petrov would remember that day and was plagued by a terrible guilt for destroying his own brethren. On the 6th of January, Paulus had seen enough of the shattered divisions inside the Kessel and signaled General Zeitzler back in Rustenburg, saying, Army is starving and frozen, have no ammunition and cannot move tanks anymore. On that same day, Adolf Hitler awarded Paulus' chief of staff and avowed Nazi Arthur Schmidt the Knight's Cross of the Iron Cross. So the condemned man got his heroic trinket. Across the Don front, General Fiebich, who commanded the 8th Air Corps, had a long conversation with von Richthofen and said, Why don't the Russians crush the Kessel like a ripe fruit? Russian officers were asking themselves the same question. But Moscow had one more card to play first. Voronov, who was to leave the assault, received a call from the Stavka telling him that an ultimatum to the 6th Army must now be prepared. Stalin wanted the Germans to go as quickly and quietly as possible so that he could refocus on Rostov and Army Group South. But it wasn't to be so simple, and that's where we'll pick up next week. Don't forget to head over to the website abwarpodcast.com, where you'll find the page for the Battle of Stalingrad podcast. If you want to reach out, there's a contact form on the homepage where you can send me a direct message on Twitter. My handle is @DesLatham. Until next episode, stay healthy.